Is Dr. Christine Huang. She is Assistant Director of Scientific Activities, Division of the American, or the AVMA. She received both her DVM and her MPH for the University of Minnesota under their dual degree program. Dr. Huang's work focuses on providing technical and scientific expertise for policy development, advocacy, regulatory, and legislative initiatives for the advancement of veterinary medicine, and thank you for that. She has worked, her specialty is public health and food safety, as well as zoonotic disease and antimicrobial resistance. She's worked with the FDA, she's worked with the FAO of the United Nations, National Pork Producers, the USDA, has done congressional testimonies, and is part of the U.S. delegation to the Codex Task Force on Antimicrobial Resistance. Dr. Huang.
Hi, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. So my presentation is basically about how AVMA bases its policies on science, particularly relating to antimicrobials and antimicrobial resistance. I have a lot of information, so I'm going to try to fly through it pretty quickly here, and might wind up skipping over a couple of slides just to get it all in on time here. But to start with, AVMA kind of bases a lot of its thought process on this principle right here, and essentially that AVMA does have a different perspective from a lot of the other medical health professionals in that, you know, we come at it from a perspective of a balance between animal health and human health and sort of the intersection between animal health and human health. And so a lot of times our perspectives and our policies aren't necessarily in line with the other health professions, and particularly the human health professions, because we do have to find that balance between animal health and human health. But we do feel that we have a role in a lot of the zoonotic diseases, and particularly in the arena of antibiotics and antibiotic resistance. AVMA does have a lot of efforts related to antimicrobial resistance, and we do get involved in these discussions a lot. We have this landing page that has a lot of information on antimicrobial resistance and antimicrobial use, where you'll find a lot of our information from our different councils and committees and task force reports and so forth. We have fact sheets, we have FAQs, we have all of our testimonies and legislative issues on this landing page, and as well as a link to all of our antimicrobial use policies. And they are quite lengthy. I think we have at least 10 or 12 of them, and I'll get into sort of the basis behind those policies in a minute. Our pathways to policy are rather convoluted and also very lengthy. A lot of times it does take us quite some time to come to our policies and how they are developed. But with all of this, we basically have our executive board and our House of Delegates. And if you think of it in terms of sort of the federal system, it's sort of similar to that. You know, we have our House of Delegates, which is kind of like the House of Representatives, and our executive board, which functions a bit like the Senate over here. And in the end, we end up with some sort of policy at the end of it, and we have recommendations that feed into the executive board and resolutions that feed in through the House of Delegates, and oftentimes we actually even have a crossover where the recommendations will go to the executive board and then they feed into the House of Delegates before they become our policies, and then we'll act on those policies here and get implemented by our AVMA staff, which I am AVMA staff. down here, you know, is staff here, and then we have our membership that feeds into our councils and committees, where we consider this is AVMA leadership, as well as our members of the HOD, which we consider also AVMA leadership. And actually, I see one of our members of the AVMA councils and committees here sitting in the audience, and so these are our integral grassroots efforts that we consider part of the policy development. And a lot of our membership feeds into our expertise that really evaluates the science behind our AVMA policies. AVMA has a lot of influence into the federal government policies, and as you heard from Dr. Sunloff earlier, there are a lot of government policies that are developed related to antimicrobial use, and this is one of them that was released recently, Guidance 209 on the judicious use of medically important antimicrobial drugs. guidance for Industry 209 was specifically related to limiting the medically important antimicrobial drugs to food-producing animals that are considered necessary for assuring animal health, as well as limiting those drugs to food-producing animals that include veterinary oversight or consultation. And specific to this particular GFI, AVMA developed a steering committee to focus on the component of veterinary oversight. So AVMA has a steering committee that works with FDA to figure out exactly how to implement that component of veterinary oversight, because it is a very complex process to figure out how exactly we're going to implement greater veterinary oversight of antimicrobial drugs. In veterinary medicine, it is very different from the way that it works in human medicine, where the drugs are available in different formats, and I'll get into that a little bit later in the presentation. AVMA is also very involved in legislative processes. We have a division in our headquarters office in the Chicagoland area in Schaumburg, and then we also have our lobbying arm in D.C. Where we work heavily in legislative efforts. AMDUCA is the Animal Medicinal Drug Use Clarification Act that AVMA developed to allow veterinarians to essentially prescribe drugs in a manner that is considered off-label or extra-label use. Extra-label use is the proper term under AMDUCA that allows veterinarians to prescribe drugs for the well-being of animals to be used in a manner that is outside of the approved drug use. And so you can read more about AMDUCA if you'd like to learn more about that. And then, And then AVMA is also involved in the implementation of regulations. We do comment on regulations for extra-label drug use, as well as the Veterinary Feed Directive. And the Veterinary Feed Directive is one of the ways that antimicrobials are available for animal drug use. AVMA is also involved in proposed legislation through our Government Relations Division office in D.C. The PAMTA, the Preservation of Antimicrobials or Antibiotics for Medical Treatment Act, is one of the pieces of legislation that we're heavily involved in, and we are opposed to this piece of legislation, which is differing from most of the medical professions, because of the fact that it limits the veterinarian's ability to use the drugs, because it does say that it would be only for therapeutic administration. And for veterinarians who treat large animals and food animals, it is very important to have those drugs available for prevention and control use, simply because we practice medicine in a manner that is more for population medicine. And as public health professionals, you may be able to understand that thought process a bit more. But prevention and control of infectious diseases is very important in production practices in terms of practicing population medicine, particularly in these large production practices that we have in food animal medicine. And as you look at the language within PAMTA, the AVMA is particularly opposed to the classes of the drugs, as well as the verbiage for routine purposes, because depending on how you define routine purposes, production practices are fairly routine. The animals are very, very similar. They come from the same genetic breeding backgrounds. And so within the production practices, everything is fairly routine. And it may be required that you use these drugs on a fairly routine practice to prevent and control disease. So that is concerning to us as an organization, that it would be restrictive and it would make it difficult to practice medicine in a way that we would need to protect animal health and welfare. And this goes into a little bit of another reason why that we're opposed to this particular piece of legislation, simply because even the FDA officials have indicated that they're not entirely sure how exactly they would be able to ascertain whether or not there is a reasonable certainty of no harm to human health, because there is no mechanism to do so. And these are some of the states that have similar legislation to PAMTA on a state level. This is something that AVMA also monitors as an association, state-level legislation, and we work with our state-level organizations to monitor legislation amongst the states and provide technical information and expertise to them as well. So this is a little bit about how antimicrobials are used overall for treatment of disease, and this would be when the animals are actually showing clinical signs. For control of disease, that would be considered when there is actually disease present in a herd or flock in some of the animals. Prevention of disease, that's where you would know that in a particular practice where there is an indication that disease will occur, and that's based on historical knowledge or something of the sort. And then production uses are considered the same as growth promotion, increased feed efficiency, improved feed conversion, or improved rate of gain. Those are uses that are generally in feed. And then antimicrobial regulation, this is what I was talking about earlier, where it's very different from human medicine, where we do have antimicrobials that are available over the counter. And when they are available over the counter, they are oral, which is by feed or water. There are injectables that are available over the counter, and there are intramammary antimicrobials that are available over the counter. At the same time, we also have prescription antimicrobials that are available in the same manner, oral, injectable, and intramammary. So there is a lot of confusion there. And then when they are available by prescription, it's regulated by the state. So it's very difficult to have a federal mandate say that all of these drugs are going to be available by prescription, because it's regulated by the state, not by the federal government. So to implement a greater level of veterinary oversight across the board, across the United States, is rather difficult logistically. And this is particularly why we have this steering committee working with the FDA to try to figure out how we're going to implement a greater level of veterinary oversight, because there are logistical challenges to it. Currently, we do have a veterinary feed directive, of which there are two drugs that are approved by the veterinary feed directive, and that does allow a greater level of veterinary oversight. A veterinary feed directive works as if it is a prescription drug for feed, but it is not necessarily the same as a prescription drug, and that is regulated by the FDA. And so the debate kind of occurs largely because of things like this that we find in the media. And a lot of it is also because, we have kind of a simplistic message here that, people see drugs going into the animal and you think it's kind of this big mixing vat, and then, the animal becomes meat, and then, there's sort of the meat goes into the human and you have resistance and that sort of thing that goes on. And so it does create headlines like this, and people have this perception that you have antimicrobial use, therefore you've got selection pressure and you've got resistance. It's a pretty simple message. But within the AVMA, we do have a huge, broad area of expertise amongst all of our membership, and they go through a fairly significant amount of thought processes as they evaluate all of the information that is available. So these are all the surveillance systems that are available around the world that we do consider and we do look at when we think about our different policies and the data that's available. So there's NORMS, and this is the surveillance system that we have here in the States. There's SIFARS, which is in Canada, DANMAP, which is in Denmark, MERA, which is in the Netherlands, and SVARM and SRUDERS, or whatever you want to call it, over there in Sweden. And actually, recently, we've also come across some data from Japan that's also in consideration now, too. So, you can see that we do go through a great amount of deliberation looking at all the data from the different countries to come to our conclusions that we debate over and over again in all of our different councils and committees and task forces and so forth. And there is, because we have such a diverse membership between academia, public health professionals, government veterinarians, food and animal practice veterinarians, small animal practice veterinarians, and so forth, there is a great deal of debate even amongst our membership and within the profession about this particular topic. This is just sort of a quick overview of NORMS. We've got the human arm of NORMS, the animal arm of NORMS, and the retail meat arm of NORMS. And when you look at this data, there's a huge amount of data that's available, and some of which isn't even, especially current. We're getting into 2012 right now, and the most recent data that we have is an executive summary that encompasses all three arms of NORMS is from 2008. This is SIFAR's data from 2005 and 2006, and I only get into this because it's fairly detailed information that we've looked at recently, particularly related to cephalosporins. And so, you know, this is something that, you know, everybody's looked at a lot, and, you know, even folks at CDC have looked at a lot. And it talks about when there was this voluntary withdrawal in Quebec of cephalosporins, you see this huge precipitous decline in resistance in human isolates, E. coli, chicken isolates, and Salmonella Heidelberg, resistance to cephalosporins. And it, you know, it leads you to the conclusion that, hey, look at all this use of cephalosporins. Once they stopped using it, you see this huge decrease in resistance. And it is, you know, it is pretty, it's pretty interesting, and it would make you think that, well, that's likely the cause of this resistance to cephalosporins. But a lot of times what other people didn't see is some of this other data that's sort of buried in the CIPARS report. Because if you go back, I guess, this particular chart is from a withdrawal in Quebec, remember that. And then you look over here, again, buried in the CIPARS report. This is Manitoba, another province in Canada. And you see the same sort of decline in Salmonella Heidelberg from the CIPARS report. And then, let's see, I don't know, over here, Saskatchewan, Alberta, same decline in Salmonella Heidelberg. So it's kind of happening all around Canada. Whether or not that's related to the cephalosporin voluntary withdrawal, we don't really know because it's not stated in the CIPARS report. And where else? Oh yeah, Newfoundland, you kind of see the same decline. So we don't really know. But point being, it's difficult to draw conclusions when you don't have all of the pieces of data. And then, again, you look at this, and it's like, well, let's see, the withdrawal happened in 2005, and, oh, look here, in 2004, it seems like there's a huge decline that started in 2004, but yet the withdrawal actually occurred in 2005. Same thing over here in Quebec. Ooh, it started in 2003 was actually the decline, so, but the withdrawal started in 2005. That's, again, interesting data. And then over here, they show the voluntary withdrawal. And this is sort of newer data that extends into 2007 and 2008. Well, you see that actually they had the voluntary withdrawal in 2005 and 2006. And then they started using the cephalosporins in 2007 and 2008 again. And you start seeing the climb to resistance. So that seems fairly convincing, and that would correlate to the theory that the cephalosporins do in fact relate to the cephalosporin resistance do in fact relate to the use of cephalosporins. So then you're kind of back to that thought process again. Again, confusing. But this is all stuff that, you know, everybody looks at and goes back and forth in debates within the AVMA and within our councils and committees. People sit around and go back and forth between all of this stuff all the time. And so it gets to be very interesting discussions within the AVMA and all of our councils and committees. And I get to sit and listen to all of these very interesting discussions. So, you know, this is yet another chart that's buried within the CIPARS report, and I only draw it to your attention because one of the things that's come up recently is that there's been some discussion about, well, what happens when you see one particular group decline? Would you see something else increase? So let's see, pink line, ciftiofur. So if you see a precipitous drop in ciftiofur resistance here, are you going to see an increase in say, a different group, say, like the tetracyclines and streptomycin? Are you going to affect a different group? You know, is something else going to fill that void? And we don't really know. So, you know, we have to be somewhat cautious in considering, well, if you do one thing, are you going to affect something else? If you withdraw the cephalosporins, are you going to find that there's going to be an increase in some other drug use to fill that void? And are you going to increase selection pressures for a different drug? And is that going to be problematic to human health or animal health? It's just a thought. But we don't know. It's just something to be considered as we develop policy within our organization. And this is just, you know, another chart that was under consideration. And this one particularly, you can see that tetracycline resistance here had increased a great deal as the ceftiofur resistance had decreased, and so that's kind of one of those things that we were thinking about as we were looking at that. Look at the cephalosporin or the ceftiofur decrease, and then the huge increase in tetracyclines and streptomycin at the same time, and that is somewhat concerning. You know, is that going to be problematic to human health or animal health? And we don't know. Sorry, this was a repeat slide. And some information from Sweden. This was just kind of interesting from a global perspective. They seemed to think that from an environmental resistance perspective, most of these drugs were relatively harmless. And this was from this first figure over here. Penicillin, the aminopenicillins, and beta-lactamases, and cephalosporins. Cephalosporins were, from an environmental and resistance perspective, relatively harmless in resistance. I thought that was really odd, because we don't think that here in the States. Cephalosporins, relatively harmless. From a resistance perspective, I just thought that was odd. So, you know, in different countries, they seem to think different things. You know, again, just some more information that we've considered coming from the different countries, and from our response to the original order of prohibition on extra-label use of cephalosporins, we did find that we thought that there were substantial amounts of data suggesting that perhaps there were mechanisms of cephalosporin resistance that may be entirely unrelated to use of cephalosporins, and apparently they had found the same thing in Sweden. The Maran report, just some data from Maran that we've considered. Also, this is the famous chart from Denmark that a lot of people look at and consider. And you know, I won't get into the debate of it, but it seems that a lot of people look at the same chart and come to differing conclusions. And it's all about data interpretation. You know, you can look at data and come to different conclusions from it. this is interesting to us because, as you know, as the years have gone by since the ban on growth promotions in Denmark, you can see that the number of exports have exponentially increased. Particularly, the exports have increased in the grow finish phase, and in the grow finish phase is where growth promoting antimicrobials would be used. So it is interesting that they banned growth promotants and have since started exporting a great deal of animals in the grow finish phase where you would use growth promoting drugs. I'm not saying that is good or bad, it's just an interesting correlation and an interesting trend. Again, more trend data from Denmark in 2009, and actually this is just kind of funny, but I recently was in Denmark to learn more about their data collection and surveillance simply because they have an amazing capacity for collecting information in Denmark, and they've decided to stop publishing this particular chart because too many people use it and they kind of don't really like it. So this is no longer found in Denmark 2010 that was recently published. So I think they don't like us using this chart because it's subject to too much debate. So it's no longer found in DanMap 2010. Again, more chart data. A lot of it breaks down to, you know, drugs used per pig produced and resistance isolates on a drug per pig per pork basis kind of thing. And again, you know, we do spend a great deal of time looking at all of these different charts and graphs and debating it amongst ourselves. on the human side, Denmark does a really good job of also looking at human data. They do collect that information. And from that, we found that the trends tend to be kind of unclear. They're either stable or increasing, but the decline isn't really obvious. So one of our JAVA reporters asked me recently, so, you know, on your trip to Denmark, what exactly did you find? It seems like they have this really great system that they built for collecting data and surveillance. Did they achieve the goal that they set out to achieve? And I guess my answer was, well, I'm not really sure. I guess it depends on what their goal was. If their goal was to decrease total use of antimicrobials, yes, indeed, they did. They absolutely did that. We do not deny that at all. They used less drugs than they did before the ban. If their goal was to improve resistance trends in humans, I can't say that that's true because they did not show me any evidence of that when I was there. So you look at these charts on the human data, And I mean, you know, it doesn't really matter what the specifics are, but you know, you've got stuff that's increasing, you've got stuff that's about the same. So it seems like everything's about stable or increasing. So did they indeed improve human health trends at all based on their ban of growth promotants in animals? I'm not really sure that they didn't show any evidence of that. They didn't make any claims to that effect. But, you know, on the animal side, they definitely did have successes, and we don't deny that whatsoever. They did eliminate the use of these three antimicrobials, so if indeed that was their goal, they did do that. And there was a significant decline in resistance of these particular drugs in these particular species because, well, they stopped using them. So if you stop using the drugs, you will see a decline in resistance in those particular animals. So that is successes on their part, if that was the goal in mind. And these are just kind of the charts to show that they did do that. And so this is some new data that came from DanMap in 2010. This is just some thought processes with A.V. May's theories behind antibiotics. These are, you know, some concerns that we've seen just in the general public with antibiotic residues. And our thought is that antibiotic residues really should not be an issue, at least here in the States. Around the world, sometimes it is an issue because they don't have the control processes that we do in place to prevent antibiotic residues from getting into the meat or the milk or the food animal products in general. But in theory, you know, you follow the flow chart, none of this should ever really happen. Antibiotic residues should not be in the food supply, period. We have the control mechanisms in place that that should not happen. So antibiotic residues should not be a mechanism by which resistance is transferred into the human food supply. There is this concern where there's a direct route of transmission of antibiotic components, whether it's antibiotic itself or more plasmids and that kind of thing. But again, you know, our thought process is that, you know, it needs to actually make it through the entire food chain, cause illness to the human. That person needs to seek medical attention and have some kind of treatment failure. And the bug actually needs to be resistant to the treatment of choice, as Dr. Sunloff was saying earlier, for it to be an actual concern. So if you have salmonella that is resistant to tetracycline, but you're not trying to treat tetracycline, then it kind of doesn't really matter. So that's, you know, that's something that we struggle with a great deal. And then there's this that that we talk an awful lot about, but it's still kind of a vague sort of concept where you know, it's kind of a bunch of plasmids floating around, and there is a potential for concern, but we still don't really know exactly how that occurs in the human gut. You know, it could, you know, you could be passing around resistance, and it is of concern, which is why we encourage judicious use of antimicrobials to protect both animal health and human health, but we really don't know how that resistance is actually conferred and transferred within the human gut or the animal gut and so forth, and so we are very careful about judicious use, and we do have a great deal of information out there for our veterinarians, and we do work towards advocating for careful and responsible and judicious use of antimicrobials. We do not encourage people to use the drugs willy-nilly, but you know, at the same time, we do caution against people using drugs in a manner that is inappropriate, because we recognize that there is a concern for resistance being transferred in a way that we really just don't know how it will affect human health or animal health for that matter. So along those lines, we do have all of these educational campaigns to ensure that drugs are used appropriately and that people follow their veterinarian's instructions and so forth and follow the federal regulations and withdrawal times and everything. And this is a bit more on our extra label drug use, which again, you know, when drugs are used not according to label, we want to make sure that they are used in the most safe and efficacious manner possible. And this is our microsite, which also has more information on antimicrobial resistance and antimicrobial drug use. And if there are any questions, I'd be happy to take them.
Time for a couple of questions.
Okay. You had mentioned that ADMA is kind of concerned with prevention and control and the judicious use. I mean, has it occurred to the body to address the primary prevention part of it all and look at CAPOs and factory farming? Any reason that all of this has increased?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. So, I think there's a huge misconception about the larger production practices and, you know, whether or not those are, you know, focused on prevention and control practices. And those farms have probably the best prevention and control practices in place, more so than some of the smaller farms. They have a great amount of veterinary oversight as well as kind of standard operating procedures in place for production flows, and there are actually studies that show that they do have a lot of veterinary oversight in terms of antimicrobial use as well as prevention and control practices that do not involve the use of antimicrobials. So there's vaccination protocols and biosecurity and things like that to minimize the need for antimicrobial use. So there is a lot of animal husbandry practices and so forth that would encourage lesser use of antimicrobials. I don't know who to go to next.
Sorry.
you spoke about residues, mm-hmm. but what about residues in the environment? Because there are so many studies showing that there are residues that get into the sediments of the water that are around agricultural areas, and by techniques, microbiological, human cleaning techniques, they can trace them back to organisms and antibiotics used in the farms. And so, and then these then get into our systems. These are food systems that people get from their hands, et cetera. And basically, we've seen the rate of MRSA infections, community acquired MRSA, go way up. So there is this, potential link to, the use of antibiotics.
Yeah, I mean, I think, from a veterinary perspective, we don't really, we don't get too far into the component of, how farms are managed, because, we try to focus on the medical side of things. But I do know that, we know that the excrement from the farms are controlled and managed in lagoons and stuff. And from what I've read, the management of those farms and are supposed to be regulated by the EPA, and my understanding of that situation is that there are just as much antimicrobials found in the water and the soil from downstream of hospitals and other Oh, absolutely not. I mean, I think it's everyone's responsibility to ensure that, our overall environment is clean and safe. I mean, when we talk about residues in the meat and in the food supply, I mean, I think that's certainly a veterinarian's concern, and that's why we're trying to focus on this veterinary oversight component. And so from our organization's perspective, for us, that's kind of the first step, is to make sure that, we've got the veterinary control part of it underway to make sure that there is no residues in the food and the meat and the milk supply. And as for what goes out into the environment, honestly, it's kind of more of a producer issue and not really a veterinary issue. We can only address the small component that we have. I mean, we're not exactly the largest organization. I don't know if I can say a whole lot about that.
To be fair, I think I'm going to cut off the questions now so we get a full, Dr. Hansen has a full half an hour. But then there will be time at the end for questions. And then at 10 o'clock is when the thing is supposed to close. But please, if you guys are willing to entertain questions beyond that, I'd be
glad to. Absolutely.
So, sorry. Thank you very much, by the way.